Dilemma Talk. Die Liebe bei Venerable Usilananda at the Tabitha Meditation Center, San Jose, California, for special retreat of November 1998.
Before we continue the discourse, I want to go back to the beginning. At the beginning of every discourse, as I said yesterday, there is an information as to where the discourse was delivered, to whom, and on what occasion. So in that opening passage, there is the word in the city, say in a certain city, in Sawati or in Rajagaha and so on. The English translation just give as, say, in the city of Sawati, or in Rajagaha and so on. But actually, the monasteries Buddha lived in were outside the cities, not inside the cities. So the commentaries explained that the locative case used in describing the location of the monastery, I mean the monasteries, indicate not in the city or inside the city, but in the vicinity of the city or near the city. So it is better to translate them as near Sawati or near Rajagaha and so on. When they chose sites for monasteries, they chose a place which is not too far from the city, not too close to the city, so it must be outside the city, and which has easy access to the city and so on. Now the city of Sawati and the Jedavana. The Jedavana monastery was built in the south of that city. So there were two big monasteries near the city of Sawati. The first one is Jedavana, built by Anatha Bendika, and the second is Ubbarama, built by Visakha. So Ubbarama means the eastern park. So that monastery was in the east of the city, and Jedavana was on the south of the city. So although this is not important for the understanding of the Dhamma, it is still good to know that these expressions indicate not in or inside the city, but outside, near the city. exhorted the monks to be heirs in Dhamma and not to be heirs in material things. And after explaining to them some reasons, he got up and went to his chamber. So when the Buddha left, the Venerable Sariputta took the responsibility of continuing the Dhamma talk. Now, sometimes commentaries give us some information not contained in the suttas. And here the commentary said, When it is said that Buddha left, Buddha did not bodily get up and left the assembly. He went out by way of mind. So that means he just disappeared in his seat and then appeared in his room, in his chamber. And the reason the commentary gave was, if Buddha bodily got up and went to his room, then the community, the multitude of monks would have surrounded and followed him, and so the audience would be scattered. And once scattered, then it would be very difficult to assemble them again. Venerable Sariputta addressed the monks as friends monks, and then they responded by saying friend. And then Sariputta continued the Dhamma talk. So at first he asked them a question. Friends, in what way do disciples of the teacher who live secluded not follow him in the experience of seclusion? And in what way do disciples of the teacher who live secluded follow him in the experience of seclusion? Actually, he asked the question not because he did not know the answer. Actually, he was going to give the answer. Maybe he wanted his audience, or he wanted his brother monks to pay close attention to his talk. So he asked this question, and then they answered, "Friend, we would have come from a very far place, far away place, to learn from you the meaning of this statement. So it would be good if you would explain the meaning of this statement to us. Having heard from you, the monks will remember it." So they requested him to explain the meaning. When they responded in this way, Venerable Sariputta once again bound them, saying, "Friends, then listen, pay good attention, I will speak." Responded, "Yes, friend," and then Venerable Sariputta said, "Now, in what way do disciples of the teacher who live secluded do not follow him in the experience of seclusion?" Then this is the question, and he gave the answer as, "Here, disciples of the teacher who live secluded do not follow him in the practice, the experience of seclusion. They do not abandon what the teacher tells them to abandon, and they go after getting abundant requisites, and they take the teachings of the Buddha lightly, and they have given up the responsibility to practice for attainment of Nibbana. What seclusion, or the experience of seclusion? Now, there are three kinds of seclusion: bodily seclusion, mental seclusion, and the third is a tough one: seclusion from upadis. Seclusion from sources, seclusion from sources of both happiness and suffering. So there are three kinds of seclusion. So bodily seclusion means living alone. Now, Buddha always experienced this bodily seclusion. Although he may, although he lived with hundreds of monks in the Jetavana monastery, He lived in his own chamber alone, and he would come out only when he wanted to say something to the monks, or there is something to be done, or to meet someone. If there is no such reason, then he would stay in his chamber alone, getting into the samapatti. So Buddha always experienced this seclusion of body, or bodily seclusion. Mental seclusion means mind being away from mental defilements and mental hindrances. So actually, the mental seclusion means getting into jhanas or samapattis. Lived in this seclusion, mental seclusion. It is said that Buddha spent his time entering into the fruition attainment of Palasamapati. Even when he was giving a talk, when the audience says sadhu, 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 so during that time, maybe it's just a few seconds, he would enter into samapatti and remain in the samapatti until the time when the audience finished saying sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. So that much he entered into samapatti. So he, let's say, he always lived in mental seclusion. First seclusion is called kaya viveka in Pali, and the second citta viveka. Now the third seclusion is upadhi viveka. And this word is a very difficult word to translate. It is translated in English as substratum of life. I don't know what that is. So we have to go back to the ancient commentaries. Now in the ancient commentaries it is said that there are four kinds of upadhis. Khanda upadhi, kilesa upadhi, kama upadhi, kilesa upadhi, abhisankhara upadhi, and what is the last one? Khanda upadhi. The desirable objects of senses, desirable sights, sounds, and so on. Now they are called kama upadhi because they are the receptacle of sources of enjoyment, sources of happiness associated with attachment. So they are called upadhi, and they are also called kama. So we put the two names together and they are called kama upadhi. So kama upadhi means just the objects, the desirable objects we always encounter, the sights, sounds, and so on. Now you know the word kilesa, right? Mental defilements. So kilesa, mental defilements are called upadhi because they are the sources of what? Happiness or suffering? They are source of suffering, right? So they are called upadhi. And abhisankhara means wholesome and unwholesome karma. So as a result of wholesome and unwholesome karma, you will be reborn in a blissful state, or maybe reborn in full woeful state. So the wholesome and unwholesome karma are called sources of the suffering of existence. So you get one existence and you suffer there. Even if you are born in the celestial state, in the end you suffer death. So wholesome karma and unwholesome karma are called upadi because they are sources of suffering in existence. Kusala and akusala karma, or wholesome and unwholesome karma, are the source of suffering in existence. And kilesas, or mental defilements, are source of suffering in woeful states. As a result of kilesas, mental defilements, there is rebirth in four woeful states. So mental defilements are the source of suffering in four woeful states. Now, the aggregates. Aggregates are also called upadi because they are the source of the suffering that is contingent on them. Now, because we get this aggregate, say aggregate of metta and all five aggregates, because we get these five aggregates, we suffer old age, disease, death, sorrow, lamentation, and so on. So these sufferings are contingent upon these five aggregates. Therefore, the five aggregates are also called upadi. So among the four upadis, the first one, karma upadi, is the source of enjoyment. And the other upadis, kilesa, abhisankara, and khanda, are the sources of dukkha, suffering. Now I think you understand the meaning of the word upadi. It's a receptacle or a source. Okay, so I think we can call them source. Now, upadi, viveka, right? Viveka means seclusion. Seclusion from these four upadis. What is that? No desirable sense objects, no kilesa, no mental defilements, no aggregates, no karma. What's that? Nibbana. So upadi viveka means simply nibbana. How did Buddha experience upadi viveka? Buddhas and arahants are persons who had reached the highest stage of enlightenment, who had realized nibbana. So they can experience that nibbana anytime they like by entering into the attainment of fruition or palasamapati. So when Buddha was in the palasamapati, the fruition consciousness arose in his mind billions and billions of times. And at the same time, the fruition consciousness took nibbana as object. So nibbana is cessation of all suffering. So when the consciousness that is taking the cessation of suffering as object, then there is peacefulness, and that is what we call happiness for arahants and Buddhas. So Buddhas and arahants can experience the upari viveka anytime they wish. And since they have this attained nibbana, since they have access to this happiness, they always go for this happiness whenever they can. So Buddha lived in seclusion, in these three kinds of seclusion, bodily seclusion, mental seclusion, and seclusion from sources. The question put by the Venerable Sariputta: in what way do disciples of the teacher who live secluded follow him in the experience of seclusion? That in that question, seclusion means all these three kinds of seclusions. But in his answer to this question, he said, disciples of the teacher who live secluded do not follow him in the practice of seclusion, and they do not abandon what the teacher tells them to abandon, and they go after gaining requisites, and they take the Buddha's teachings lightly, and they have given up responsibility or attempt to practice in order to reach nibbana. So in the answer, seclusion means, in the first sentence of this answer, seclusion means just the first seclusion, bodily seclusion. Three sentences. The first sentence has to do with bodily seclusion, and the second sentence with mental seclusion, and the third sentence with seclusion from sources. But in the question, seclusion means all three seclusions. The first sentence was, they do not practice body seclusion. And the second sentence was, they do not abandon what the teacher tells them to abandon. That means they do not practice mental seclusion. And then the main thing in the third sentence is, they do not practice to gain nibbana. So they do not practice to gain seclusion from sources, upari viveka. So if monks do not practice the first seclusion, that means if they live in a crowded place, and if they communicate with each other, if they socialize with each other, then they are not following the Buddha in the practice of bodily seclusion. And if they do not practice meditation to get away from the mental defilements and mental hindrances, then they do not practice the mental seclusion. And if they do not practice vipassana to attain nibbana, then they do not practice that seclusion. And Venerable Sariputta said, if they do not follow the Buddha in this practice of seclusion, then they will be blamed. They will be blamed for these three reasons: that they do not practice body seclusion, they do not practice mental seclusion, and they do not practice seclusion from sources. So here, the Venerable Sariputta divided monks into three groups: the elder monks, and middle-aged monks, and younger monks. Now, in Vinaya, those who are 10 years and over as monks are called elder monks. And those who are from 5 years to 9 years as monks are called middle-aged monks. And those who are new and who have not reached the 5th year, so that means 1 to 4 years, are called new monks. So there are three kinds of monks: new, middle, and elder monks. So from 1 to 4 years, new; 5 to 9 years, middle; and 10 and above, elders. And then there is another distinction made, that is, if a monk has been 20 years and more as a monk, he is called the great elder. So there are two kinds of elders: elders and great elders. So we can call a monk who has been a monk for 20 years a great elder, or Mahathera. That is why you will see the word Mahathera in some books, when they give the name of the orders, Mahathera. So when you see the Mahathera, you can know that this monk is at least 20 years old as a monk. And they are to be blamed for these three reasons, because they do not practice body seclusion, they do not practice mental seclusion, and they do not practice upadhi seclusion. Now, the opposite of that is that the Venerable Sariputta put the question, in what way do disciples of the teacher who live secluded follow him in the practice of seclusion? Then the answer is, they practice seclusion of body, of mind, and of souls. So when they practice all these three seclusions, then they will be praised just for these three reasons: because they practice body seclusion, because they practice mental seclusion, and because they practice seclusion from sources. Now, the Venerable Sariputta continued the teaching of the Buddha, but he did not mention the word Dhammadayada, I mean Dhamma heritage. But when he said that if you practice these three kinds of seclusion, you will be praised, you will be praiseworthy. So that means if you take the Dhamma heritage, then you will be praised. So that means he is indirectly encouraging the monks to take the heritage of Dhamma. Because only when they take the heritage of Dhamma will they practice the three kinds of seclusion, especially the third seclusion, seclusion from sources, that means Nibbana. So, although the Venerable Sariputta did not use the word Dhamma heritage, he was actually encouraging his brother monks to take the Dhamma heritage, to practice meditation and to gain enlightenment. So the Venerable Sariputta has mentioned, when he talked about the mental seclusion, he mentioned, or he said, that the monks do not abandon what the teacher tells them to abandon, and they abandon what the teacher tells them to abandon. Now, he wanted to elaborate on that. What are the states that the teacher tells them to abandon. So the Venerable Sariputta mentions the mental state one by one that are to be abandoned, and also told them that there is this middle way to abandon these mental states. So the Venerable Sariputta said, "Friends, greed is evil, and hate or anger is evil." Now, there are 16 mental states he pointed out, and he paired two mental states each, and so there are 8 pairs and 16 mental states. So the first pair is of greed and hate. So he said, greed is an evil state, and hate or anger is an evil state. And there is the middle way for the abandoning of greed and hate. Venerable Sariputta said, greed is evil and hate is evil. That means greed is unwholesome and hate is unwholesome. Why are they unwholesome? Because they themselves are blameworthy and they give painful results. So these are the two characteristics of being unwholesome state. They are blameworthy and they give painful results. That is why they are said to be unwholesome or evil. Sariputta did not just mention these mental states, but he pointed out also that there is a way, a middle way for the abandoning of these mental states. So if he did not mention these, the monks would be at a loss what to do. So he mentioned the middle way, and he followed the Buddha in describing that middle way, that it gives vision, it gives knowledge, and it leads to cessation of mental defilements, it leads to direct knowledge, it leads to penetrative knowledge, and it leads to Nibbana. So I hope you know the middle way. It is called the middle way because it does not approach the two extremes. The first extreme is indulging in sensual pleasures with the belief that they will get rid of, they could get out of samsara by enjoying the sensual pleasures. And the other extreme is inflicting pain upon oneself or self-mortification. And their aim is also to get out of the samsara. But Buddha described these practices as unfruitful, profitless. So they do not lead to getting out of the samsara. So, and Buddha, before he became the Buddha, practiced both these practices. When he was a prince, he followed the first extreme, and when he was in the forest and practicing meditation, he followed the second extreme. And when that second extreme did not give him the desired results, he reviewed his practice of self-mortification and then came to the conclusion that it was a wrong practice. And he discovered the middle way and the right way when he remembered an incident in his childhood, when he was just an infant. His father, King Suddhodana, held a plowing ceremony. So at the ceremony, he was left under the tree, and the nurses went to see the performance of the king. And so when he was alone, he set up and practiced meditation, and he got into first jhana, and he remembered that it was very peaceful. So when he remembered this, he decided that this is the real, I mean, the right way. So he followed the right way, he practiced the right way, and he became the Buddha. So when he gave his first sermon, he said, "Monks, there are these two extremes, that a recluse should not practice, and I have found or discovered the middle way," and he taught the middle way to the five disciples. And what is this middle way? This is the noble path that has eight components, namely right understanding, right thought, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. So these eight components as a whole are called the noble path, or now they are called noble eightfold path. Eightfold means just having eight components, like a medicine composed of different ingredients. So the middle way and the noble eightfold path are the same. So sometimes it is called the noble eightfold path, and sometimes it is called the middle way. And as you all know, the noble eightfold path is the fourth noble truth. Now, among the four noble truths, the fourth noble truth is just this middle way of the eightfold path. Now, we must understand that the eightfold path is of two kinds. The real eightfold path and the preliminary eightfold path. The real eightfold path is the combination of these eight mental states that arise at the moment of enlightenment. So at the moment of enlightenment, the path consciousness arises. Along with the path consciousness, these eight mental states and also some others arise. And it is these eight mental states that really eradicate the mental defilements. So when we say this is the path to Nibbana, we understand that the eight mental states at the moment of the path consciousness are the real path. Because once a person is on that path, he is sure to reach Nibbana. Now, in order for the path consciousness to arise, and in order for these eight factors to arise, you have to do something. They will not arise by themselves. So, the practice that leads to the arising of the path consciousness and these eight mental states are also called eightfold path. They are not the real eightfold path, But since they lead to the real path, they are also called Eightfold Path. And they are called preliminary, because they precede the real path. Without the preliminary path, there can be no real path. So the preliminary path is also called the Eightfold Path. So we have two kinds of Eightfold Path, the preliminary and the real. And the real is supramundane, and the preliminary is mundane. So in describing the middle way, the Venerable Sariputta here used some words to describe it, and they are that it gives vision, it gives knowledge, and so on. So these, let us call them qualities. These qualities can be applied to both the real path and the preliminary path. Now, at the moment of enlightenment, path consciousness arises. And that path consciousness takes Nibbana as object. And it is said that the path consciousness functions four things. Understanding the first noble truth, abandoning the second noble truth, realizing the third noble truth, and developing the fourth noble truth. So these are the four functions that path consciousness does at the moment of enlightenment. And it does these four functions simultaneously, not one after another. These four functions are explained with an analogy of a lamp. So you light a lamp, and the moment you light the lamp does the four functions simultaneously. Dispelling darkness, producing light, burning the wick, and making the oil diminish. So these functions a lamp does simultaneously. In the same way, path consciousness does the four functions, the understanding, fully understanding the first noble truth, abandoning the second, realizing the third, and developing the fourth simultaneously. Enlightenment is called the realization of four noble truths, or sometimes realization of Nibbana. Now, the path consciousness takes Nibbana only as object. It does not take First Noble Truth as object, Five Aggregates as object. It does not take craving as object. It does not take the eight factors as object. It takes Nibbana only as object. But when it takes Nibbana as object, it virtually fully understands the first noble truth, abandons the second noble truth, and develops the third noble truth. Not that it takes them as object, because at one time only one object can be taken. But when the path consciousness arises, taking Nibbana as object, the other functions are also done. So we say that at the moment of path consciousness, the four noble truths are realized. Let us see the qualities. The first quality given is it gives vision. The Noble Eightfold Path gives vision. It gives seeing. Seeing what? The Four Noble Truths, right? So it gives seeing the Four Noble Truths. That means when you get the eight factors arise, then you see Nibbana. I mean, you see the Four Noble Truths. It gives knowledge. Same. It gives knowledge of the Four Noble Truths. And the third is, it leads to cessation of mental defilements. At the moment of enlightenment, mental defilements are eradicated. There are four stages of enlightenment, and at each stage, a little of the mental defilements are eradicated. And so when a person reaches a fourth and final stage, all remaining mental defilements are eradicated. So this Noble Eightfold Path leads to the eradication of mental defilements. It leads to the direct knowledge, again, the direct knowledge of all the special knowledge of Four Noble Truths. It leads to penetrative knowledge. Here also, penetrating into the Four Noble Truths. It leads to Nibbana. It leads to the cessation of all aggregates. But in this way, these qualities are for the Noble Eightfold Path or the Supramundane Path. The preliminary path, we will have a different understanding. Well, first, what is a preliminary path? It is vipassana. So without vipassana, you do not reach the supramundane path. So the vipassana path is called preliminary path. Also gives seeing or vision, gives knowledge, and leads to eradication of mental defilements and leads to direct knowledge, leads to penetrative knowledge, and leads to the cessation of aggregates. Okay. It says that it gives seeing or it gives vision. So what vision does vipassana give? You've already experienced vipassana and you already know. Okay, I'll leave it for tomorrow.
Uh-huh.